And all of this hatred that was done was a kind of hatred that had skillfully been taught to us without us even realizing it. We begin to hate ourselves. Now, you know, they accuse us of teaching hate. What is the most inhuman or illegal or immoral or immoral? For a man to teach you to hate your enemy, or a man to skillfully maneuver you into hating yourself? Well, I think to teach a man to hate himself is much more criminal than teaching him to hate someone else. And look at you. Who taught you to hate yourself? If you say we're hate teachers, you tell me who taught you hate so skillfully and so completely until we have been maneuvered today so that we don't even want to be what we actually are. We want to be somebody else. We want to be someone else. We want to be something else. And many of us want to be somewhere else. Then after 1959, Africa began to get its independence. And as these African states got their independence, they began to change the image of the African. They've gotten a position to put image abroad, and the image began to swing from negative to positive. And to the same degree that the African image began to change from negative to positive, if you study the behavior pattern of the Afro-American, his image also during the same period began to change from negative to positive. His behavior began to change from negative to positive. His objective began to change from negative to positive to the same degree that the behavior and the objectives of the African changed from negative to positive. They had a direct bearing. Upon the attitude that we here in America begin to develop toward each other and also toward the man. And I don't have to say what man. There were elements in the State Department who began to worry about this changing image, because they knew that to the same degree that the image of Africa changed, your and my image of ourselves began to change. As Africa became militant and uncompromising, you and I became militant and uncompromising. And even the most bourgeois, Uncle Tom, Afro-American, was happy when he hear about the Mau Mau. Because, yes, he was happy when he hear it. He wouldn't say so openly, because it wasn't a status symbol to identify with it in some quarters. In other quarters, it was. But all of this uncompromising and militant action on the part of the Africans created a tendency among our people in this country to be the same way. And they were having this effect upon us, but many of us didn't realize it. There was a subconscious effect, an unconscious effect, but it had its effect. And as I say, there were elements in the State Department that became worried about this, that racist element in the State Department. And you're out of your mind if you don't think that there's a racist element in the State Department. I'm not saying that everybody in the State Department is a racist, but I'm saying they sure got some in there, and a whole lot of them in there. And they got them in powerful positions in there. And this is the element that became worried about the changing Negro mood and the changing Negro behavior. And especially if that mood and that behavior became one of what they call violence. And by violence, they only mean when a black man protects himself against the attack of a white man. This is what they mean by violence. They don't mean what you mean. Because if they're against violence, they don't even use the word violence until someone gives the impression that you're about to explode. When it comes time for a black man to explode, they call it violence. But white people can be exploding against black people all day long. It's never called violence. Because I even have some of you come to me and ask me, am I for violence? I'm the victim of violence, and you're the victim of violence. In fact, you've been so victimized by it, you can't recognize it for what it is today. Their fear was that the changing image of the African would have the tendency to change your and my image much too much. And they knew that as the image of Africa changed, you and I tended to identify with Africa where we didn't formerly do so. You and I tended to sympathize with Africa where we didn't formerly do so. And their fear was that that sympathy and that identity would eventually develop into a sort of an allegiance for African hopes and aspirations above and beyond America's hopes and aspirations. And so they had to do something to create a division among the Afro-American or between the Afro-American and the African so that you and I and they could not get together and coordinate our efforts and make faster progress than we have been making up to that time. They don't mind you struggling for freedom as long as you struggle according to their rules. As long as you let them tell you how to struggle, they go for your struggle. As long as they let you, you let them tell you how much not, you know, to exert too much energy, then they go for your type of struggle. But as soon as you come to one of them who's supposed to be for your freedom and tell him you're for freedom by any means necessary, he gets away from you. He's for his freedom by any means necessary, but he'll never go along with you trying to get your freedom by any means necessary. The United States history is the history of a country that does whatever it wants to by any means necessary. It looks out for its interest by any means necessary. But when it comes to your and my interest, then all of the means become limited, and we can't go along with that. We say what's good for the goose is good for the gander. If we're going to be nonviolent, then let America become nonviolent. Let her pull her troops out of Saigon and pull her troops out of the Congo and pull back all her troops everywhere. And then we will see that she's a nonviolent country. And we're living in a nonviolent society. But until they get nonviolent themselves, you're out of your mind to get nonviolent. That's all I say on that. I'm for peace. But I don't see how any black people can be at peace before the war is over. And you haven't even won a battle yet. If I have to follow a general who's fighting for my freedom, and the enemy begins to pin peace medals upon him before I've even gotten my freedom, I'm afraid I'll have to find another general. Because it's impossible for a general to be at peace when his people don't yet know peace. And it's impossible to give out peace medals when the people who are oppressed don't have any peace. The only one who has peace is the man at the top. And I don't think black people should be at peace in any way. There should be no peace on earth for anybody until there's peace also for us. So after 1959, I'm getting right to the end of it, after 1959, another thing came into the picture. The African nations began to get very nationalistic and very militant and very uncompromising in their search for freedom, and it put the European powers on the spot. They were blocked. They couldn't stay on the African continent any longer. It's like someone who's in a football game. When he's, or a basketball game, when he's trapped or boxed in, he doesn't throw the ball away, but he has to pass it to someone who's in the clear. And this is the same thing that the European powers did on the African continent. They were colonial powers. They had the image of colonial power. And they were trapped. They were boxed in. The Africans didn't want them anymore. So they had to pass the ball to one of their partners who was in the clear. And the only partner that they had in the clear was Uncle Sam. And Uncle Sam caught the ball. He's been carrying it ever since. He's been carrying this ball ever since, and all you have to do is go to the African continent, travel from one end of it to the other, and you'll find out that the American position and influence has only replaced the position and influence of the former colonial powers, and they did it very skillfully. They knew that that the Africans had awakened and had become too militant for any non-African to stay on that continent against the will of the Africans. So they had to use a better method, a more subtle method, a friendly method, a benevolent method, a philanthropic method. And they had to make friends with the African. They had to make the African think that they were there to help them. So they started pretending like they wanted to help you and me over here. They came up with all these pretty slogans about integration, which they haven't produced yet. They came up with slogans about this kind of program and that kind of program, but when you analyze it very closely, you find that they haven't produced it yet. It hasn't produced what it was supposed to produce, and it's so hard for it to produce results that when they get that much of it, it makes headlines. When they get that much progress, it makes headlines. So they went into the African continent with a new form of missionary who went there to pose as a friend in this 20th century, as if he's going to help the Africans. While over here, the Afro-American is getting his head busted. He's getting dogs were being sicked on him, not by the Ku Klux Klan, but by men in police uniforms. It would be different. You wouldn't be so shook up if a Klan had his dog biting you. But when you see the policeman with his dog biting you, you wonder what's happening. Because you're not breaking the law, you're trying to enforce the law. The law was handed down by the Supreme Court. They said you can go to any school you want. But when you get out there and get ready to go to school, like the law says, the law is the one sticking the police on you, or busting you upside your head, or turning the water hose on you, or the cattle cross. So this kind of shook the American, the Afro-American up. He wondered, was the Supreme Court really in a position to say what the law of the land was supposed to be? Because they passed a law that they could not enforce. They passed a law that they could not implement. And I don't mean that they couldn't enforce it in New York City. They couldn't even desegregate the schools in New York City. And how in the world are they going to desegregate them in Mississippi and Louisiana and some of those other places? So, these were token moves designed to make you and me cool down just a little while longer by making us think that an honest move was being made to get a solution to the problem, or an honest effort was being made to get a solution to the problem. And then as they began to appear that they were for the black man in this country, they abroad, they would blow it up, especially the USIS, United States Information Service. Its job abroad, especially on the African continent, is to make the Africans think that you and I are living in paradise, that our problems have been solved, that the Supreme Court desegregation decision put all of us in school, that the passage of the Civil Rights Bill last year solved all of our problems, and that now that Martin Luther King has gotten the Peace Prize, we're on our way to the promised land of integration. I was over there when all of this happened, and I know how they use it. They don't use it in an objective, constructive way. They use it to trick and fool the African into thinking that they don't, most of their time is spent loving you and me and trying to solve your and my problem with honest methods, and that they're getting honest results. So I would like to say, in my conclusion, why we in the Organization of Afro-American Unity feel that we just can't sit around and use and rely upon the same objectives and strategy that has been used in the past. If you study in this country the so-called progress of the Afro-American, you go back to 1939, just before the war with Hitler, and most of our people were dishwashers and waiters and shoeshine boys. It doesn't make any difference how much education we had. We worked downtown in those hotels as bellhops, and on the railroad as waiters, and in the Grand Central Station as red hats. We knew what our position was going to be even before we graduated from school prior to 1939. And in Michigan, where I live, the big shot Negroes were the waiters out at the country club. But back in those days, when you had a job waiting in the country club, you were rubbing elbows with the highest of the white folks, and you were considered a big shot because you were rubbing elbows with the big shot. Actually, you were rubbing elbows with them while you were serving them. And in those days, our people couldn't even work in the factory. In Michigan, where all the factories are, they worked primarily shining shoes and at menial tasks. And then when Hitler went on the rampage, America was faced with a manpower shortage. And this is the only time you and I got a break. Some of you are too young to remember it, and some of you are so old you don't want to remember it. If you go back to 1939 and 40 and 41, a black man couldn't even join the Army or the Navy. They wouldn't let us join the Army or the Navy. They didn't want us in the service because they were afraid if they trained us on how to use a gun, they wouldn't have to tell us what the target was. There were white folks and the army, white war, actually. And we were behind here, we're beginning to get good jobs and some other things. So there was a manpower shortage. And the Negro leaders, and in this instance I have to say Negro leaders, the Negro leaders got up in arms. They went to Washington and demanded that Negroes be drafted too. Really they did. Really they did, they did. They weren't drafting us. The Negro leader in that day, he was the same way then as he is now. Went to Washington and says that if white boys are going to die on the battlefield, we want to die too. And it was then and only then that they started taking us into the army. And they wouldn't put us in the area where you can handle guns. And even some of them who were in the army in those days will tell you that when they landed at the Battle of the Bulge or in Italy, they wouldn't give them bullets to their guns. They were afraid. And they had reason to be afraid because they knew what they had done to us. And I, for one, I say they had reason to be afraid. Because anybody in his right mind who has had done to him what you and I have had done to us, don't give us a chance because, well, you know, we're human. They let us in the plant, in the defense plant. When we got in the defense plant, we began to get jobs as machinists. For the first time, we got a little skill, made a little more money. And by making a little more money, it was then and only then that we were in a position to live in a little better neighborhood. And when we moved to a little better neighborhood, we had a little better school to go to and got a little better education. This is how we came out of it, not through someone's benevolence. And it was not through the effort of organizations in our midst that made us go forward. It was the pressure that Uncle Sam was under. And the only time that man has let the black man go one step forward has been when outside pressure has been brought to bear upon it. It has never been for any other reason. World pressure. Economic pressure, political pressure, military pressure. When he was under pressure, he let me and you have a break. After he had defeated Hitler and got Tojo and the Japanese out of the way, then Stalin was on the scene and he was a threat. And it was during that period of uncertainty in this country that you and I got in a position to get a little better job, make a little more money, live in a little better neighborhood, go to a little better school and get a little better education, so that today you can think a little bit better than you could think back in those days. And I mean a little bit better. So the point that I make is, when you study the world situation, and then put your and my position of progress or lack of progress during the past 20 years in this proper context, you can see that it has not been so much the effort, the internal effort alone of different organizations and different leaders that has enabled you and me to make what we think is progress. It has only been to the same degree that the world itself will have pressure upon the United States that you and I have made any kind of step from here to here. But it has never been just on our own initiative. And the day that you and I recognize that, then we see the thing in its proper perspective. Because we see, looking just to Uncle Sam in Washington, D.C., to have the problem solved. And we cease looking just within America for allies in our struggle against the injustice. We begin to look at the whole problem, not as a Negro problem or an American problem, but a world problem. And when you see it in its world context, you look around on this earth and you find out, whereas as long as you keep it in the American context, you're a minority. You're the underdog, and the odds are against you. And you can hardly ever go forward on your own volition or of your own initiative. But when you look at it in its world context, you find that you're no longer the underdog. That the people who look like you are the most numerous. That the odds today are on their side. that the pendulum and center of power is shifting. Whereas it used to be predominantly in Europe and America, Europe and America don't hold the power anymore. Power balances are shifting. Today, Asia has power. Africa has power. Dark-skinned people in Latin America have power. Well, when you find people who look like you getting power, my suggestion is that you turn to them and make them your allies. Let them know that we all have the same problem, that racism is not an internal American problem, but racism is an international problem. Racism is a human problem. And racism is a crime that is absolutely so ghastly that a person who is fighting against racism is well within his rights to fight against it by any means necessary until it is eliminated. And when you and I can start thinking like that and we get involved in some kind of activity with that kind of liberty, I think we'll get some ends to our problems almost overnight. Thank you.